From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! Opening arguments are heard in the Giallo trial. Today, an update in the case of the four New York police officers charged with murdering an African immigrant. Also, nonprofits financed by corporations are trying to influence the elections using issue ads, but some are not revealing the true source of their funding. And we'll hear from Professor Noam Chomsky as President Clinton returns from Davos, the World Economic Summit. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. The Senate overwhelmingly approved legislation yesterday that would make it harder for people to wipe out their debts in a major overhaul of the nation's bankruptcy system that was sought by the credit card industry but decried by consumer groups as unfair. The bill also includes a proposal to raise the hourly minimum wage by $1 to $6.15 over 3 years and to cut a variety of business taxes by $76 billion. Passage of the bill was 83-14, and it came on a day of high-level political gamesmanship that drew Vice President Gore off the campaign trail in case he was needed to break a Senate tie on a controversial amendment to block the use of bankruptcy laws by violent demonstrators at women's health clinics to evade fines and damages. This international news, with protesters yelling that he's a fascist far-right leader, Haider and his coalition partner arrived today to meet with Austria's president, who must decide whether to approve their proposed new government and risk reprisals from the rest of Europe. President Thomas Klestil was expected to reluctantly confirm the coalition today, despite threats of European sanctions and protests from abroad against a government with Haider's anti-immigrant Freedom Party. In an attempt to spare Austria international isolation, Klestil summoned Haider and Wolfgang Schäuble, head of Conservative People's Party and the likely new chancellor, to a meeting where they were to sign a, quote, declaration of values of European democracy. This news from Belfast. Two Protestant militants were convicted and sentenced to life in prison yesterday for the 1998 murders of a Catholic man and his Protestant best friend. Under terms of Northern Ireland's peace accord, however, the pair could win paroles within months. Judge Brian Kerr convicted Stephen McLean and Noel McCready of murdering Catholic Damien Traynor and Protestant Philip Allen as they sat discussing Allen's wedding plans in a pub in the village of Points Pass. The Points Pass pub attack happened in March 98. The anti-Catholic gang that took the blame called a ceasefire the month after the accord to qualify for the parole program. This news from South Carolina. With the nation's eyes turning toward South Carolina for this month's Republican presidential primary, Governor Jim Hodges says the fight over flying the Confederate flag from the state capitol needs to be resolved soon. He said yesterday, "This is an opportunity for us to show everyone in the state and the nation that South Carolinians can take a difficult problem that has plagued us for some time and find a way of resolving it." His comments came after flag supporters and opponents met for 7 hours with key senators trying to broker a compromise. In his State of the State address, Hodges said the flag should be moved from the Capitol Dome, where it has flown since 1962. This news from Nairobi, Kenya. Seasonal rains were not enough to ease a drought in large parts of this East African nation, leaving at least 2 million Kenyans in need of food aid. This according to the UN World Food Program. The World Food Program appealed to donor nations for $43 million to purchase food for the needy over the next 5 months. Kenya has a long rainy season between March and May and short rains between October and December, but for the past several years, they've not been enough. WFP said in parts of eastern Kenya, people have eaten seeds meant for planting. Republican presidential candidate George W. Bush is being urged to avoid a dinner Saturday where his dad will be the keynote speaker. The Texas governor is scheduled to get a Governor of the Year award from Safari Club International during its annual convention in Reno, Nevada. But the Humane Society of the United States says Safari Club International is not the kind of group the governor should associate with. The Humane Society says the club promotes the killing of rare species. A spokesperson for the governor says Bush hasn't seen the Humane Society's letter for him, but understands he's being honored for his conservation work. And four prison guards in Florida charged with beating a prisoner to death make their first court appearance this morning. All four are accused of second-degree murder in the death of Frank Valdez last July. He was on death row for killing a prison guard in 1987. The four were among nine guards suspended after a confrontation in a disciplinary area at Florida State Prison near Stark.
The night air is heavy, no cool breezes blow. The sounds of the voices are worried and low. Desperately wondering and desperate to know about Goodman and Schwerner and Cheney. Calm desperation and flickering hope. Reality grapples like a hand on the throat. For you live in the shadow of 10 feet a row. If you're Goodman and Schwerner and Cheney.
You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Four white New York City police officers accused of murdering Amadou Diallo unleashed a 41-shot barrage with no warning and kept firing as the victim was down on the ground, this according to prosecutors' opening arguments yesterday in the trial of the officers. The six-man, six-woman jury in the trial also heard from the state's first witness yesterday as NYPD, that's New York Police Department crime scene detective, who testified finding the sidewalk, stoop, and outside vestibule of Giala's Bronx apartment building littered with bullets. The officers, Sean Carroll, Edward McMillan, Kenneth Boss, and Richard Murphy, face 25 years to life if convicted of the second-degree murder of Diallo, who was gunned down February 4, 1999, in the lobby of his apartment building. The slaying touched off widespread demonstrations against police brutality and impunity in New York City, and acts of civil disobedience led to over 1,200 arrests. The trial was moved to Albany after an appeals court ruled that negative publicity made it impossible to find an impartial jury in New York City. Bronx County, the original venue for the trial, is 39% white. Albany County, where it is now, is about 89% white. We're going to first go to a report filed by Jad Abumrad. He's a reporter with Pacifica Radio's WBAI in New York.
In the 1990s, in Bronx County, in Albany County, or anywhere else, a human being should have been able to stand in the vestibule of his own home and not be shot to death.
That was how Bronx prosecutor Eric Warner opened today's trial. Warner claimed the four officers on trial never called out warnings like stop or don't move before they opened fire on the 22-year-old West African immigrant. Warner's remarks gave an early indication that the prosecution will be focusing its arguments on the number of bullets fired. 41.
We will prove by the number of shots fired at very close range that these four defendants intended to kill him, who therefore are guilty of murder. We will also prove by the number of shots fired at this man at very close range and into the vestibule of an occupied dwelling that these four defendants acted recklessly and with depraved indifference to Amadou Diallo's life and the lives of the people who lived. When all of the evidence is in, it will be clear to all of them, beyond a reasonable doubt, that these defendants were not justified in firing all of those shots that penetrated an occupied dwelling, let alone in killing Amadou Diallo, who was armed with nothing more than his wallet, his beeper, and his keys.
The defense painted a picture of Diallo as a suspicious-looking suspect who, after failing to stop on their command, turned and pointed a dark object at them. Defense attorney Bennett Epstein countered prosecution claims by saying that the four officers identified themselves with their badges, and that it was Diallo who forced them to act in what they thought was self-defense.
Members of the jury, we believe that the evidence will show that had Mr. Diallo stopped to answer the officers' questions, the whole thing would have ended peaceably moments later and we wouldn't be here.
Epstein went on to say that the 41 shots, which to many activists have become a symbol of excessive police force, were actually fired in under 4 seconds. And that burst of gunfire was the result of fear, instinct, and training.
Now, ladies and gentlemen, we're going to prove to you what was going through Sean Carroll's mind as he sees this reaction from Mr. Diallo, and as he sees the series of events unfold and the black object coming out of Mr. Diallo's pocket towards him. His training is going through his mind. His experience is going through his mind. He's full of fear. And we will prove to you, ladies and gentlemen, exactly what was going on in his mind, because he verbalized it. When the black object came out of Mr. Diallo's pocket in that dimly lit vestibule, he yelled, "Gun!"
For the rest of the day, attention turned to the prosecution's opening witness, Joseph Flanino of the NYPD Crime Scene Unit. Flanino was among the first on the scene after the incident, and it was his job to document every aspect of the shooting. For several hours, the prosecution used Flanino's testimony to carefully construct the scene of the slaying, the vestibule of Diallo's Bronx apartment 1 year ago this week. They showed a model of Diallo's neighborhood and numerous photos of bullets scattered in the hall outside Diallo's apartment and on the street outside. Flanino's testimony raised the issue that may define the trial. Light. Was it too dark for the officers to see Diallo as he stood in his doorway, or was there enough light for them to make an informed judgment? Flanino claimed that the streetlights outside Diallo's window provided illumination enough for him to write in his notepad without turning on the lights. The defense reminded the jury that Flanino did not actually witness the shooting, and that lighting conditions may have been different at the time. Outside, protesters continued their demonstrations. In an emotional moment, Amadou Diallo's father took the podium.
Right in his doorstep, on cold blood. Cold blood. He have nothing on his hand. Shooting him, killing him, is another. Shooting him 41 times, this is discrimination.
In a case fraught with racial tensions, the defense petitioned courts to move the trial from the Bronx to Albany County, which is largely white. Defense attorneys claim that large numbers of police in the Bronx harbor inherent distrust toward the police. Yesterday, defense attorney Stephen Wirth chided Reverend Al Sharpton, who has led the protests, for creating what he called a circus outside the courtroom. And in court today, Wirth tried unsuccessfully to convince the judge that ongoing protests have created political pressure which has biased the trial.
How did we get here? We got here because there was a furor created by people who have their own agendas to forward over this shooting and who wanted to
say, find your comments to what you believe the proof will be.
We believe the proof will show the total absence of any motive in this case other than self-defense.
Legal experts predict that in the coming days, the issue that will take center stage is the trajectory of the bullets which killed Amadou Diallo. Prosecution experts are expected to make the argument that Diallo fell down after the first few bullets and was shot while lying down. The defense is expected to counter with experts of their own who claim Diallo was standing during the incident. The trial will continue tomorrow at 9:15 a.m. I'm Jad Abumrad.
And that report from WBAI Pacifica reporter Jad Abumrad. You are listening to Democracy Now! As we turn now to a guest who was in the courtroom yesterday, Rosa Clemente, co-chair of the Capital Region Justice for Diallo Committee. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you.
Can you tell us, from your perspective, what it was like inside and outside the courthouse yesterday?
Well, outside we did have some protesters there in a vigil a little bit after noon when the lunch break occurred. I was mostly in the courtroom later on in the afternoon, but was watching the opening arguments on court TV, and I was rather disgusted, to say the least, that particularly Stephen Wirth and his opening arguments could allude to the fact that destiny brought us to this day. That
Stephen Wirth being the defense attorney.
Right, and just to see the look on Mrs. Diallo's face later on in the afternoon, it was just such a painful experience for her and the entire family, but just that this man could get up there and say that destiny brought us to this place. If he had only listened to police commands, he wouldn't have been shot at this many times. We found that repulsive, to say the least.
Can you tell me a little more about your group, the Capital Region Justice for Giallo Committee? Where are you based and how was it formed?
Well, we were formed a couple of days after the venue change was announced, understanding the reasons why the venue change was brought to Albany, but also understanding that many people here, or many people outside of the Albany area, don't think that there are activists here and don't think that we would be able to pull off something like this where we would be a daily presence in front of the courthouse. We're based at an organization called the Social Justice Center, but our committee is really a coalition of many, many groups that just came together very quickly and just started organizing to support the family, but also to deal with our issues up here of police brutality and terror.
What kinds of issues are you talking about in the Albany area?
Albany has a long, long history of police brutality. As far back as 1984, when Jesse Davis, a mentally ill man, was shot by the police, and the autopsy pictures showed that all he had was a toy truck in his hand, to last year's beating of a college student, Jerome Henderson, outside of a bar in a college area by two officers who had previous numerous complaints filed against them by many other Albany residents. These two officers beat this college student and weren't even indicted. November 13th of this year, while police were looking for an alleged shooting suspect, they basically came into the Arbor Hill Community Center, which is the black community in the Albany area, one of the black communities, and basically came in as stormtroopers on a Sunday morning looking for this alleged shooter, going to businesses, ransacking homes, and they also came out in SWAT and riot gear. So we have a very brutal history of Albany police tactics.
Back to the trial of Amadou Diallo. You talked about the defense opening argument. What about the prosecutor's opening argument, and were you satisfied with that?
I was definitely satisfied. I think the prosecution did a great job with the first witness, also the detective that was on the scene. And I think later on in the afternoon, when the defense attorneys were questioning the detective that was the first one on the scene, they tried very hard to talk about things like, was the scene contaminated? Once you left the scene, do you think people were angry enough to kick the bullet fragments around and to kick the door and things like that? I don't think that worked. And I think the defense attorneys have not only opened doors to things like looking into these police officers' background by saying something about the Civilian Complaint Review Board and things like that. I think they're not going to be seen as, I don't want to say conciliatory, but I don't think the jury is going to like them, particularly Stephen Wirth. I think he was very abrasive, and some of the things he said would have been repulsive to anybody in that courtroom.
Well, Rosa Clemente, I want to thank you for being with us, co-chair of the Capital Region Justice for Giallo Committee based in Albany. Again, Albany, New York's capital. It is 89% white, and that is part of the controversy around the placing of the trial there. It was originally going to be held in the borough of the Bronx, which is overwhelmingly people of color. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. Let's see how the Washington Post put it this weekend after President Clinton returned from Davos, Switzerland. They said President Clinton urged leaders of the companies that most benefit from global trade to reach out and listen to those opposed to globalization, telling some of the world's most powerful political and business figures, don't leave the little guys out. Clinton, the first U.S. president to attend the annual Davos gathering, delivered what amounted to an appeal for compassionate free trade to the prestigious World Economic Forum in this Alpine village. The Washington Post goes on to say, while endorsing free markets and world trade as indispensable engines for prosperity, he warned his audience of 1,000 entrepreneurs and political figures that it's partly up to them to ease fears over globalization among less developed countries, labor unions, and environmental activists. Well, today we're going to hear a different view of globalization, and that is from Noam Chomsky. He's a professor of linguistics at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, author of many books, well-known political analyst and critic. He gave a speech recently called Globalization, the New Face of Capitalism.
The systems of world order that take shape are not the results of natural law, certainly not historical or economic laws. They come from human decisions in human institutions, which can be made in different ways. Margaret Thatcher, her famous slogan was what she called TINA, there is no alternative. That's ideological claptrap. There's plenty of alternatives. The alternative that she preferred was one that was contrived and instituted in the interests of certain sectors of overwhelming power, and they're the ones who, not surprisingly, benefit from the arrangements that they instituted. Whether we choose to accept them or not is another question. This is also true of what are very misleadingly called markets. Markets, in whatever form they take, are also constructed, managed, designed in specific ways. In our particular system, and this goes back for hundreds of years, markets are typically double-edged. Market discipline is a great thing for the poor and the vulnerable. But for the rich and the powerful, they demand and receive protection from the nanny state. That's the way markets have always been, with very rare exceptions, and it's dramatically true in the United States. We call this a free enterprise economy and so on. That's only very partially true. For one thing, it's largely managed internally to huge tyrannies called corporations, which are interlinked in all sorts of ways in strategic alliances and so on. Quite apart from that, if you have the power, you expect protection from the state. And that's not marginal. If you look over the dynamic sectors of the U.S. economy today, telecommunications, internet, computers, biotechnology, automation run through it, and look into their history, you'll discover that virtually without exception, they were developed, designed, and paid for by the general public, but at public expense. So cost is socialized, profit is privatized. Furthermore, risk is socialized. You read that the IMF bails out countries when they get into trouble, but that's highly misleading. It doesn't bail out the countries. It bails out the lenders and the investors, makes sure they don't have to take a risk for their risky and therefore high-yield investments, and the country pays for it. The poor of the country, so you take, say, Indonesia, the people who are paying to ensure that the lenders and investors get paid off are the poor people of the country who never borrowed the money in the first place, and by and large, you quite often not only didn't gain from it, but even suffered from it. But they're the ones who pay. Along with Western taxpayers who are expected to provide the free risk insurance. And this is true across the board. There was a year or two ago a major technical study by two European economists of the 100 leading transnational corporations in the world on the Fortune list, they found that every one of them had benefited substantially from state protection, that means taxpayer subsidy, and about 20 out of the 100 would not have survived as businesses if it hadn't been for public bailouts. Now, we're not talking about marginal facts. This is core elements of the economy. If you personalize it, you find it even more so. So in the Senate, Trent Lott, House Senate Majority Leader, was described by the London Financial Times a little while ago, the major national, international business daily. He was described as the chief pork producer in Congress for his rich constituent. That's the way the system works. Market discipline is perfect for poor people in El Salvador or working mothers in the slums. They have to learn responsibility, but not the rich and the powerful. They have to be protected. That's the truth about neoliberalism. It's double-edged, and that goes back hundreds of years. That's a good part of the reason why the third world is the third world and the first world is the first world. You go back 200 years ago, they weren't very different. They diverged enormously, and there are a lot of reasons for that, but one substantial part of the reason is that the third world had market discipline rammed down the throats by force, whereas the first world, England, the United States, Germany, Japan, without exception, every developed country, had a powerful state initiative that protected and developed the economy, and that continues right till this moment. So that's what's called markets. They're designed in particular ways. Well, who makes these decisions? In the international arena, the decisions are made by states. To borrow George Orwell's phrase, some states are more equal than others. The ones who are most equal are the ones called G7, the seven rich industrial countries. So they have an overwhelming effect on state decisions. And of G7, the one that's far and away the most equal is, of course, the United States, which since the Second World War has had a position of overwhelming international power, and no historical precedent to that, and of course has used it to design a world in the interests of powerful sectors within. Alongside the powerful states, there are the institutions that they've designed, the international financial institutions, the IMF and the World Bank, the World Trade Organization, took over from GATT a couple of years ago. Those are institutions of global dominance, global control, which are themselves controlled by the rich countries and primarily by the United States, which once again has an overwhelming influence. The states themselves are not autonomous agents. They don't act as a degree of autonomy, but to a very large extent, as you'd expect, what they do reflects the internal distribution of power. So what is called U.S. policy is a reflection to a significant extent, a very significant extent, and always has been, of the distribution of power within the United States. And that's no secret either. That power is largely lodged, especially through the 20th century and increasingly today, in major collectivist concentrations of power, private, which are internally tyrannical, linked to one another, and control a substantial, huge part of the domestic and international economy. The corporate systems, the industrial and the financial institutions, which are increasingly transnational. The extent to which they control the international economy is growing and enormous. Just to give one index, and there are many, the sales of affiliates, foreign affiliates of transnationals, so affiliates of General Motors operating abroad and so on, the sales of affiliates of transnationals alone is considerably greater than total world trade. In the last 25 years, this is a major and significant change, something without precedent in the history of industrial capitalism. There has been a huge explosion of financial institutions and financial capital, almost all speculative. Very little of it has anything to do with the real economy, maybe 5%. And that is an enormous flow. The flow is now estimated at about $1.5 trillion a day. Very little of it productive. In fact, the speculative flow, about 95% of it, is mostly destructive, not productive. The degree to which it's speculative is illustrated by the return time on investments. So, you know, lend capital flowing abroad and back. About 80% of it has a return time of less than a week, much of it less than a day, even hours and minutes. The scale is fantastic. The $1.5 trillion a day is over twice the total foreign exchange reserves of all states together, which means that that has an overwhelming, they can easily overwhelm any government, in fact, any combination of governments. Well, all of that is highly concentrated, reflects an extraordinary degree of concentrated and interlinked power, and it determines to a substantial degree what state decisions are, and it does it in many ways. For one thing, the executive branch of the states is largely drawn from these institutions, so you know, lawyers from corporate law firms and so on. Secondly, they virtually own Congress. The extent to which that's true, and it's increasing, again, just to illustrate, in the latest elections, the 1998 congressional elections, roughly 95% of winning candidates outspent their opponents, which means if you had the money, you won. Where'd the money come from? Well, a ratio of 12 to 1, business outspent labor. Well, labor represents way more people. So you have a tremendous concentration of ability to buy candidates in the hands of a very small sector, namely the business world, same corporations that staff the executive. If you look at private contributions, figures that are available indicate that about 0.25% of the population provided 80% of the contributions. Again, that tells you who's buying the elections. The money isn't given for charity. It's given because you expect a return, and the return comes. The money incidentally goes to both parties. May vary a little bit one way or another, but the point is to buy them all. You get a return. So in the 1996 election, for example, as Tom Ferguson is a very good political scientist here at UMass, has been working on these topics for many years, pointed out that the election was to a large extent bought at the, particularly toward the end, by the telecommunications industry, which poured a huge amount of money into it, enough to get Clinton elected, in fact. And they got something, namely the Telecommunications Act of 1996, which is a huge giveaway of public property, maybe on the order of $100 billion. It was so blatant an act of robbery that it offended a lot of conservative opinion and got some publicity because of that. Bob Dole, who was running for president, condemned it bitterly as corporate welfare. He then had the facts of life explained to him, and he ended up backing it. There were never any hearings called on this huge giveaway, and there was no media coverage, because the public isn't supposed to know about these things. This is just the way your lives are controlled and organized. An even bigger giveaway, this one is incalculable, you don't know how to measure it in dollars, is the giveaway of the internet. That's very recent. 4 years ago, in fact, it was commercialized, handed over to private power. A year before that, in 1994, Bill Gates, for example, saw so little potential in the internet that he refused even to go to conferences about it. 1995, figured what he could do with it. This had been developed for 30 years within the public sector at public expense, and it was handed over to private power, and it's now considered, you know, kind of like the leading edge of the economy. How did that happen? Well, answer is nobody knows. No one knows how the decisions were made to commercialize the internet. It was done somehow, hints and bits and pieces here and there, but it was not a public decision, and it was, you don't exactly know who made it. It again has enormous effects on life, but secret. Well, that's the way, you know, the executive and parliamentary branch of the government work. In a way, more important than this is that private power sets the conditions within which policy is made, no matter who's in charge. Standard way of referring to it in the economics literature is that global capital markets have veto power over government policy. That's a little too abstract. A global capital market sounds like some kind of, you know, abstract institution that couldn't be controlled. But global capital markets means the institutions in whose hands the capital is concentrated. So we're back to the same nexus of mostly by now financial and industrial corporations. That's capital markets to an overwhelming extent. And yes, they do have veto power over policy. Investors and increasingly speculators now constitute what some economists call a virtual Senate, a Senate that can veto what they consider irrational policy. Irrational policy means policy that is designed to help people, not profits. So, for example, social programs, health, education, labor rights, women's rights, various things like that. That's irrational. Efforts to stimulate the economy, improve labor bargaining power, redistribute income, whatever it may be. And that can be punished, in fact, terminated, simply by withdrawing capital from the country. Huge, when there's $1.5 trillion circulating per day, totally overwhelming government, the virtual Senate has it can determine what policy will be, deviate from their decisions, and country goes down the tube. For the poorer countries of the world, that's just the virtual Senate has overwhelming power. But the same is true even for the rich countries. That was illustrated in the United States in 1992, when there was a little misplaced concern when Clinton came in. That he might mean some of the things that he had said during the campaign. And of course, during the campaign, you have to appeal to voters and sort of say things they'll like and so on. And that concern was manifested very quickly in a very sharp increase in bond interest rates. They were driven up, which is a signal that the country is going to go down the tube, capital flow out of it, unless you shape up. And ensure, for example, that there's no irrational federal spending, like for the population. You have to have federal spending to control, to socialize cost and risk, but not for the general population. And that was followed, that's what's called the New Democrats, like the old Republicans. Policy is set very clearly that way. The liberalization of capital has the effect of opening countries up to this veto power. And not surprisingly, liberalization of finance has quite consistently led to severe problems, often catastrophe, for the poorer countries. South Korea is a dramatic example. Had a huge and very impressive growth rate without historical precedent. It was compelled under U.S. pressure to liberalize its financial markets early in the 90s, and it very quickly went into a huge tailspin. The numbers indicate that it's coming out, but they conceal the fact that a lot of the economy is by now foreign-owned, things that were picked up on a fire sale, basically. Well, that's the virtual Senate, which is able to set policy that way, no matter who happens to be sitting in one or another office.
Professor Noam Chomsky, recently speaking in Boston about globalization, the new face of capitalism. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute.
You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. John McCain and George W. Bush have taken their battle for the Republican presidential nomination to South Carolina, where McCain is wooing reformers and Texas Governor Bush is courting conservatives. McCain is trying to turn his New Hampshire landslide into the cash necessary to keep his presidential campaign going. His campaign's website took in $500,000 in contributions within hours of McCain's victory over Texas Governor George Bush in Tuesday's Republican primary in New Hampshire. National Finance Chair Herb Allison huddled yesterday with fundraisers who had come to New Hampshire for the primary and held a conference call with others in their home states. But George W. Bush is certainly not wanting in cash. He has been raising, to say the least, a tremendous amount of money. In fact, just after last March, when he put out his one-page letter announcing the formation of the Bush Presidential Exploratory Committee, within a month he had collected an astonishing $7.6 million, half of the first flurry of checks coming from Texans, but also thousands of checks signed by longtime supporters and old friends of his dad, the former President George Bush. Governor Bush's vast nationwide network of fundraisers will soon begin actively raising the huge unlimited political contributions known as soft money. But Bush himself has already begun to quietly raise soft money for Republican state party committees. And today we're joined by two guests we had on yesterday to continue this conversation about the money. Andrew Weed is with us. He's research director of Texans for Public Justice, an organization that just put out a report on Bush's campaign funds called the Governor's Gusher. And Peter Eisner is with us. He's managing director of the Center for Public Integrity, which has put out an excellent report called The Buying of the President 2000, the authoritative guide to the big money interests behind this year's presidential candidates. Welcome back to Democracy Now!
Hi.
Hi, how are you?
And I want to welcome you both back to Democracy Now! I'm going to want to begin with Peter Eisner of the Center for Public Integrity and the whole issue of nonprofits that don't exactly look like the nonprofits I usually think about and how they're connecting to the campaigns.
Well, if we take a step back, what's really going on is that political campaigns have found that they have to have novel new ways of getting around laws that say that there are limits on what corporations and groups can provide to individual candidates. So one of the means of subterfuge is to put together a nonprofit organization, which is really just a matter of filling out some forms and not really disclosing very much about who you are or what you represent, and then funneling millions of dollars in many cases into that nonprofit so that the nonprofit can perform tasks that a campaign really is doing. The types of things that they can do are organize, put together ad campaigns on radio and television, do phone banks and things like that. And it's a very effective way to circumvent the hard money limits on each political candidate. And you find across the spectrum that dirty tricks and all different types of operations can be run, as long as in legal interpretations, which are probably dubious, these organizations don't specifically say vote for such and such or vote against such and such. But it can get pretty down and dirty anyway.
Give some examples.
Well, for instance, the most recent example was an organization called Hands Across America, which first surfaced in New Jersey when Bill Bradley was running for re-election as senator against Christine Whitman. There was concern about Bradley's position on taxes, and this group, Hands Across America, which was largely funded by Republicans, set up a massive campaign against him that almost succeeded in throwing him out of the Senate. The group is basically defunct, but the name has resurged recently in New Hampshire, going against Bradley, lashing out against him on his policies, and not really saying who they are, what they are. And we find out that it's really, once again, based in New Jersey, has murky funding. The head of it is an admitted criminal who spent some time in jail, I think, for cocaine smuggling, or charged with that. And
who's that?
Stop me there. I don't have the file on me.
Okay.
You probably have it.
I mean, are you saying it's a Republican?
Yeah. Republicans... Republicans putting together money to stop Bradley that still have a vendetta against him from New Jersey. And really, when you see Hands Across America, it sounds like people with an interest in certain values and certain positions. But behind that is a nonprofit with money pouring in from Republican leaders in New Jersey that want to break the back of the Bradley campaign. That's not the only case. It runs the gamut. One of the most popular things to do is for one of the Democrat or Republican victory committees to put together a nonprofit and then, say, form an organization called Senior Citizens Against Higher Taxes, and then to put very sympathetic-looking people on television who say, well, I'm really worried about my Social Security tax. I just don't know what's going to happen. What's wrong with Congress anyway? And you see a coffee clutch of people worrying about what's going to happen if things go the way they're going. That really could end up with being a conservative policy group that's trying to instill fear among senior citizens that maybe the Democrats aren't such a good bet. And there's really no way to know very easily. Eventually, reporters can dig into the nonprofit records, find out who's the registered director of the nonprofit, and eventually come up with some disclosure items. But it's extremely murky, extremely circuitous, and it's a wonderful way for parties to get around the idea that they have to be answerable for the positions and policy statements that they make.
And what about, there was a piece in the Washington Post just a few days ago, Think Tanks, Corporations, Quiet Weapon. And it particularly focused on Citizens for a Sound Economy and also talks about the people who are fanning out, in this case, through New Hampshire, wearing T-shirts or clad in signature red jackets emblazoned with the organization's web address on the back.
Right. That's just another one of the tactics that can be used. What we're looking at, we're going to be investigating what that group is and every other group. And on our website, people are going to be able to take a look. Our website, by the way, publicintegrity.org. We're going to be doing a systematic look at what we think will be a proliferation of such groups that spring up, have their own websites, have their own organization with very murky funding, and put together something that's absolutely acceptable under the law, but questionable when you really look at the underpinnings of it, which is advocacy ads. People that are pushing positions that the parties and candidates have seen are hot buttons on getting sway votes to one side or the other, reaching out, could be out patrolling the streets with T-shirts, very much more often radio call-in shows, advertisements on radio and television and such things. And there's no identification of who the folks are. One of my favorites is a series of ads, and I say favorites in quotation marks, a series of ads that talks about what would have happened to the little girl whose mother almost decided to have an abortion, and here she is a happy, healthy child, blah, blah, blah. At the end of the ad, you see the Arthur S. Moss Foundation. No one would know that that's really run by Deborah DeMoss, the former chief of staff of Jesse Helms. In other words, an extreme conservative viewpoint being played in select markets for select political reasons that doesn't name a candidate but tries to soften up the position on a certain issue.
In the case of the CSE, the Citizens for a Sound Economy, the Washington Post points out, along with earmark contributions from companies such as Exxon and Hertz, the organization received more than $1 million from Philip Morris at a time when Citizens for a Sound Economy was opposing cigarette taxes. Phone company U.S. West gave $1 million to CSE, pushing deregulation that would let U.S. West offer long-distance service. And the Washington Post got a copy, a rare look at the think tank's often hidden role as a weapon in modern corporate political arsenals, looking at the issue of these groups getting involved with these political campaigns. As I said, we're also joined on the phone by Andrew Wheat. Texans for Public Justice is his organization. He's research director there, which put out a report on Bush's campaign funds called The Governor's Gusher. Andrew, can you share some more of these groups and where they're getting their money from and how they're operating in the campaign?
Yeah, well, one such group that's operated in this current campaign is a group that's called the Republican Leadership Council. And the Republican Leadership Council is getting its money from the very same people that are funding Bush's campaign, some wealthy donors. And there's an enormous crossover between the Republican Leadership Council and Bush's own donors. And they put out an attack ad against Steve Forbes back in November that was one of the more unusual attack ads I've ever seen. In the extent to which it was brazenly hypocritical, the Republican Leadership Council put out an attack ad in November attacking the Forbes campaign for any attack ads that it might run in the future. So the nature of the attack was that to watch out, this guy's going to put out an attack ad, yet this message is coming through an attack ad itself. So it was jujitsu political advertising. A voice comes on the air in the ad and says, "Now I see you just might start in again with those negative ads. Somebody needs to tell Steve Forbes that if he doesn't have anything nice to say, don't say anything at all." This actually was the subject of a complaint that Forbes filed with the Federal Election Commission, basically arguing that the funding for the Republican Leadership Council was coming from the same sources that Bush was getting his funding, and that it was basically a front group for the Bush campaign. The Republican Leadership Council gets its money from some large donors who I think are frankly embarrassed by the right wing of their party, the anti-abortion zealots, the people that are sort of the religious wingnuts of the party. These people want to take back the White House, they want to take back Congress, and they think the way to do that is to have a more centrist Republican Party. And they're trying to get these the Steve Forbes types, the Gary Bowers, out of the picture. And this is their way of doing it in the most recent ads that we've seen. On the board of this particular group are a number of Bush's so-called pioneers. These are the people that are raising $100,000 apiece for the Bush campaign. So far, the Bush campaign has disclosed the names of about 177 pioneers who have basically accomplished the mission. They've delivered the $100,000, which, due to federal funding limits, they have to contact 100 people and get each of them to give $1,000, which is the individual limit. There are, however, said to be more than 400 of these pioneers who, if they all succeed in their mission, will deliver $40 million at least to the Bush campaign. This is a level of fundraising we've never seen before. And basically, the pioneer structure, like the nonprofits that do attack ads, like soft money, is a way to wiggle around federal limits, which, of course, the Supreme Court just recently upheld again and said limits are legal. They're not a violation of our First Amendment rights. But there are a lot of big donors who want to get around these limits and want to keep buying and peddling influence after they've reached the limit. And there was an organization set up some years back in Virginia called Triad Management, and it was basically a boutique set up for very wealthy donors who had very strong political interests and wanted to keep on giving after they'd maxed out on their limits. So what Triad would do would be set up some of these nonprofits and funnel this money from wealthy donors through themselves to the nonprofits and do attack ads. And some of the big money for that operation was coming from the Koch brothers, spelled K-O-C-H, out of Wichita, Kansas, David and Charles Koch, who gave $25,000 to Bush's gubernatorial races down here in Texas. Kochs own Koch Industries, one of the largest privately held companies in the United States, an oil company, and have had a variety of pollution complaints and lawsuits, including here in Texas. They settled a big $10 million lawsuit filed by fishermen in the Nueces Bay down near Corpus Christi back in 1998. They recently settled a large case with the state of Texas and a number of other states in the Southwest for pipeline leaks all over the Southwest that polluted the land and water. So the Koch brothers were moving quite a bit of money through Triad, as was another individual who might be the kind of person that the Republican Leadership Council is concerned about, who also happens to be a big Bush donor. His name is James Leininger. Leininger is a physician out of San Antonio who is an entrepreneur, got into making oscillating hospital beds, of all things, that are designed to prevent bed sores. Very expensive, high-tech beds, which, as it turns out, triggered a number of lawsuits themselves by patients and nurses who said the beds dropped them, crushed them, or sprayed them with silicone. This experience got James Leininger extremely interested in the tort reform issue, which seeks to make it harder for communities, workers, to file lawsuits against large corporations.
Well, Andrew Wheat, I want to thank you very much for being with us. Texans for Public Justice, how can people find out more about it?
On the Internet, the easiest way, www.tpj.org. TPJ as in Texans for Public Justice.
And Peter Eisner, Center for Public Integrity, that is www.publicintegrity.org, based in Washington, D.C. And I want to thank you both for being with us as we wrap up this program. Democracy Now! Is produced by Maria Carrion and David Love. Errol Maitland is our technical director. I'm Amy Goodman from the studios of WBAI in New York. Thanks for listening to another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!